The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Hey, Jerichoholics. Thanks for downloading Talk is Jericho. Charlie Benanti from Anthrax and Mike Portnoy of the Winery Dogs, two of the greatest rock drummers in the world today, joining the show to talk about all three of our favorite bands, the Beatles. 50 years ago, the Beatles came to the United States for the first time, and we're going to talk all things John, Paul, George, and Ringo. But first, Valentine's Day, it's on Friday. Don't forget, warning, 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 Valentine's Day is on Friday, but hey, don't panic if you haven't planned or you don't have any presents for that special someone. Take a breath, because I'm going to be helping you out. I am looking out for you. I'm hooking you up with Sherry's Berries, giant freshly dipped strawberries covered in white milk and dark chocolate. These tasty treats are huge. My mouth is watering just thinking about them right now. Here's the deal. Get these amazing, fresh, delicious berries from Sherry's Berries starting at $19.99. Or double the berries for just $10 more. Trust me when I say this is a winner for Valentine's Day. These strawberries are giant. They're dipped in chocolate, then covered in chocolate chips, decorative swizzles, covered in nuts. These things are sweet, Daddy. But the only way to get this killer deal is to visit berries.com. Do you know how to spell berries? It's berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner of the page and type in Jericho, J-E-R-I-C-H-O. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right corner and type in Jericho, J-E-R-I-C-H-O. H-O, get your Valentine's gifts in order. Do it now. Sherry's Berries, baby.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler,
best-selling author,
actor,
and lead singer of Fozzy.
Now
he's rocking the podcast world.
This
is Talk is Jericho.
Talk is Jericho.
Starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. I am Chris Jericho, and this is the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll. The remedy for boredom is here. Yeah! Come on! The official theme song for Talk is Jericho. And around the world, people are dancing and singing. Bounce, bounce, skunk, bunny, sing, long, 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 bounce, bounce, don't, bouncing, bouncing, gong, gong, gong. Man, I like it. That gets me pumped up. Anytime you hear Mo Cowbell, I'm just going to walk around with a cowbell all day long and just hit that whenever I'm feeling down, depressed, and lonely. What do you think? I'm really excited today. We got an amazing show with Charlie Benanti from Anthrax and Mike Portnoy from the Winery Dogs, talking about my favorite band, the Beatles. We watched the Ed Sullivan special, the 50-year Grammy anniversary of the Beatles appearing on Ed Sullivan. It was a great show, but the funny thing was I had been planning on watching it all week. I mean, it was like, you know, the reunion of Paul and Ringo and all these really cool people playing Beatles tunes and showing clips of the Beatles and the interviewing Paul and Ringo in this day and age by David Letterman. So anyways, it's this big special, and all week long I was super excited about it. I had it put on my DVR. I was getting ready to tape it, as I say sometimes, displaying my age. Hey, can you tape that for me? Can you tape it for me? Now you record it on DVR. There's no such thing as tape anymore. Who still has their VHS collection? I do. And it's almost like having a cassette collection. Like, it's really, there's a few places you can play them. I think I might have a VHS in my house, a VCR in my house, but I'm not sure if I still do, but I think I do. And I have a lot of, like, I have so much stuff, like, you know, early wrestling matches and even early Fozzy shows. I remember when I think my mom put all of our home movies onto VHS tapes. That was like the big thing to do at the time. We're going to transfer all of our home movies over to VHS. And now they're just like totally archaic, don't even work. Do you still got your VHS tapes?
Because what do you do with them? You can't give them away. Like, I've got Dumb and Dumber in DVD, and plus you can just get it on, even DVD is archaic now. You can just get it on demand, but I don't want to get rid of my Dumb and Dumber VHS tape. It might be worth something someday, as everyone used to say. Anyways, do you still have your VHS collection? If you do, let me know on the Twitter, at Rock is Jericho. So, anyways, back to the story about the Beatles Grammy special. I had the DVR set. I was out of town. I came home. The show had just ended. I went to click on it to make sure I had taped it. And only the first 30 minutes had been included. And then it cut off. Because 30 minutes of the show recorded, and then my kids have like every cartoon in existence on record. So anytime Teen Titans comes on, it records. You know, Tom and Jerry records. SpongeBob, Adventure Time, whatever. You know? All of these shows record. So I have like 1,000 cartoons on my DVR, you know, lineup. So it's like the worst ever. I come home and it's only half an hour recorded. So now I'm scrambling. Like, what am I going to do? Like, I have to see this thing. I've been waiting to watch it all week long and it's been cut off by the Teen Titans. And don't get me wrong. I'm as down with the clown, with Changeling and Cyborg and Starfire as the rest of you. But to not be able to watch the Beatles reunion after 50 years, Paul and Ringo getting together to sing Beatles tunes, and it's not on. So I quickly run over to the computer. I'm going on YouTube. Can't find anything. It's not even up yet. Or, you know, go to CBS.com. Go to all these places, and it's nothing. Shiza. So then I finally figured out, find it on Daily Motion. And as I'm watching, slowly but surely, all of the clips from the show are coming up. So I was like, finally, saved the day. Got to watch the whole thing. And I also saw a couple other clips from the last Jay Leno, which I don't know if you watched. Like, I never really watched The Tonight Show. But you watched the last one, and it's like you're crying. Like, Jay is retiring. And I remember when Johnny Carson retired, I was crying. And now I'm watching Jay Leno retire, and I'm crying. And I was thinking about, like, I'm proud to be part of the Tonight Show history. Like, I did Jay Leno 3 years ago when I was on Dancing with the Stars, and it was one of my favorite moments of my career, because my whole life I grew up watching the Tonight Show, watching Johnny Carson, and always wanting to be on that show. Like, to really prove you've made it, you have to be on the Tonight Show. Until you're on the Tonight Show, you're not really a star, right? So the deal was, I was on Dancing with the Stars, and if I could last, you know, through this certain week, if you can get advanced on Monday, you can do the Tonight Show on Wednesday. But you have to still be in the running. You have to still be in the contest. If you're not, they won't take you on the show. So it's like I practiced super hard that week, because I knew if I win and go to the next round, I'll have the ultimate reward of being on the Tonight Show. So I get on the show, and I got my own dressing room, and I take a picture of, like, you know, Chris Jericho, Tonight Show. And I just, I can't believe I'm actually here. And Jay walks in before, he wears, like, we call it the Canadian tuxedo. Jeans and a jean shirt. Like a long sleeve jean shirt and jeans. And he's like, I remember we were on the WCW before. We did WCW together. And it's somewhere between Jay Leno and Curly from the Three Stooges. But as you know, I am a master impressionist. So I talked to him for a bit about when he did a WCW wrestling match where he was tag teaming with Hulk Hogan. As ridiculous as that is, that's a story for another time. And the first guest comes on, and you know, you watch from the green room, watch from your dressing room. My private dressing room, thank you. Had wine in it. And Diane Lane is the first guest. Now, Diane Lane, super crush on her. From when she was on The Outsiders. Remember, she played Cherry? Oh, I loved her on The Outsiders. But I'm watching her now. It's like really friendly and polite, but just super boring. She's like, and I woke up this morning and the crickets were chirping outside my window. It was so beautiful. And I'm like, yeah, crickets are chirping all right throughout the studio. Tumbleweeds are blowing by and people are just begging for somebody to come out there and give them some pizzazz, some razzle dazzle. So when it's my turn, I come out there and exactly do that. I'm just talking, and I'm like, I'm so excited to be here. I do not want Jay to cut me off and go to break. Like, this could be my only chance. So I'm just going to keep talking. I'm not going to stop talking. And usually, I was the second guest on the show, and usually second guests on The Tonight Show get about 6 minutes. But I just kept talking and talking and talking, and you could tell because I do my suit jacket. And I do it up again. Then I undo it. Then I do it up again. It's like my only kind of like subconscious nervous reaction. I keep drinking water. There's a cup of water on Jay's desk, and I'm drinking it, you know, and I'm talking. And it was good, you know, people are laughing, and I'm getting some good results, and Jay's like, this guy's a character, and Diane Lane's actually smiling. I ended up going for 10 minutes. 10 minutes as the second guest on The Tonight Show is like prime real estate. Like, you just don't get that type of airtime. And so afterwards, you know, everyone's, you know, like I said, I did a good job. I'm not just saying that to be an egotistical, you know, guy. I actually, as they say in the biz, I killed it, Shecky. I killed it. And then when I was finished, Jay's shaking my hand. He's like, thanks. You can come back anytime. I really enjoyed it. It's kind of turning into Mike Tyson now. And I realized that I've been drinking out of this mug on Jay's desk, and there's a mug on my side of the table too. And I realized I was drinking water out of Jay's cup the whole time. And I was like, I'm so sorry, Jay. Is this your cup? He's like, yeah, don't worry about it. I'll get another cup of water. And right then another person comes, like a PA comes, whisks the cup away and puts a new cup down. Like, the cooties of Jericho will not touch the lips of Jay Leno ever. And of course, I was invited to come back anytime, and I've tried to come back about 3 or 4 more times, and they passed. So anyways, I was on The Tonight Show once. I might never go back on again, but still, I'm part of the history of that show. It was a great time, and congratulations to Jay Leno for a tremendous career, and looking forward to my boy Jimmy Fallon taking over. I love Jimmy. Maybe I'll get on The Tonight Show now that Jimmy's running it and calling the shots. So anyways, I watched that on Daily Motion, the final show of Jay Leno, and finally was able to watch the entire Beatles 50th anniversary of the Ed Sullivan Show Grammy special. It was unbelievable. Lots of cool information to talk about. Did you know that the Ed Sullivan Theater, where Letterman records now, holds 700 audience members and 50,000 people tried to get seats for that show? The Beatles were unknowns at that point in time. 50,000 people tried to get tickets. 73 million people tuned in. That was record setting. Listen to this. 45% of American households with television sets watched that show. That's insane. That's like almost 50% of the country, of the population of the United States, watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. Insane. It was masterly huge. It was one of the, it basically changed pop culture as we know it. And that was back on February 9th, 1964. Charlie Benanti from Anthrax, Mike Portnoy from the Winery Dogs, also ex Dream Theater, are joining the conversation to talk all things Beatles. We were friends before, but being Beatles fans made us even better friends. And if it wasn't for the Beatles, none of us would have been in bands. The Beatles have kind of started off everything. I don't know about those guys, but if I wasn't in a rock band or I hadn't been a wrestler, I probably would be a florist. God, I wish I was a florist. It's my one regret in life. But before we get to Beatle talk, let me take a moment to show my sponsors, my sexy beast sponsors, a little love and affection. I can't live without your love and affection. GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix is one of them. Amazing, amazing product. I love it. I use it. It's powerfully simple way to meet online, and it's so easy. You got a meeting in L.A. and you live in Sheboygan, Wisconsin? Sign up for GoToMeeting from your computer or smartphone or tablet, then launch your first face-to-face meeting in seconds. No matter where you are, just turn on your webcam and instantly be face-to-face with your team. You don't have to get on a plane. You don't have to get on a steam ship. You could just go to meeting.com and see whoever you want instantly. You can also share your screen so you can collaborate on projects in real time. It lets me take care of my podcast business with my LA crew, yeah boy, right from the comfort of my own home. I can see everybody, talk to everybody. It's like we're all in the same room together. GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix is so cool. You gotta try it for yourself. It's fruit, baby. That's why Jerichoholics, you can start your free 30-day trial today. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code Jericho. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code Jericho, J-E-R-I-C-H-O. Check out GoToMeeting now.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's a very special episode on the close to the 50th anniversary of the Beatles hitting America, one of the biggest experiences in pop culture, music, history. And to discuss this fine moment and all things Beatles, two of my best bros, Charlie Benanti from Anthrax, is here in studio and calling in from the Amsterdam Hilton while he's having his bed in. Mike Portnoy from Winery Dogs and Transatlantic is here. This might be the earliest you've ever woken up in your adult life, Mike.
Oh, my God. Well, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, right, as they say.
That's right.
That's the way I got to keep thinking
exactly.
About it.
We were talking yesterday how apropos it is that you're calling from bed. It's a total Lennon thing to do.
Totally.
But as soon as I woke up, I'm only sleeping in my head.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking about all the Beatles songs I heard about waking up. There's
Good Morning.
Here Comes the Sun.
Good Morning.
Good Day Sunshine.
I'm So Tired.
Yeah, I'm so tired. I'm only sleeping. So
good night.
Exactly. Well, we were just talking earlier. The Grammy Awards in Los Angeles. Charlie was there and didn't just meet one Beatle. He met two. He met both surviving Beatles. Had you ever met the Beatles before?
Our first Grammy experience was late 80s, and they did it at the Radio City Music Hall,
mm-hmm.
and Ringo was there.
Okay.
But we never actually met,
mm-hmm.
but we were like, there's Ringo, and I remember it was Ringo, and then there was James Brown to the left.
Wow.
So my mind was completely blown.
But yesterday
was a good experience, man.
You actually, you beat them up kind of, you roughed them up a bit.
Well, what happened was we were doing the red carpet thing, and then Ringo got rushed in, and his wife was there, and he's with Joe Walsh, because I guess Walsh is doing this...
The All-Star Band.
Mm-hmm. So we're waiting on the side, and Ringo comes walking up, and kind of stops, and I'm like, what do you have to say? Hey, Ringo, you know? So he stops, oh, how you doing? You know, and I go to shake his hand, but he doesn't shake hands. He does like the Larry David kind of elbow thing.
Yeah.
So he puts his elbow up to me, and I put my elbow up. As he puts his elbow up, he knocks his glasses off. And it becomes this thing, and it's like, oh my God, Ringo's glasses. Oh, get security, you know? So he fixes himself, he laughs, and he says goodbye.
That's good, though. It's like there's somebody took a picture of it, and like Mike said, it looks like one of those pictures of Kiss without their makeup in the 70s. Ringo without his glasses.
I haven't seen Ringo without his glasses in like 20 years, man.
Yeah, you're right.
All I could think of was I would hear like George Harrison yelling like, he's a fiendish thingy. And it's me. It's like my elbow.
And then later on.
So later on during the telecast, my daughter says to me, Dad, I have to go to the bathroom. So I'm like, okay. Let's go. So we get up out of our seats, go to the bathroom, but you can't leave the telecast till there's a commercial break.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to wait in the wings for that moment. So we're waiting, and then who comes strolling in? Paul McCartney.
That's crazy.
Wow. I hate when that happens.
But, Mike, I'm going to say something to you after this, too. He comes walking in with his wife, and he immediately stops and sees my daughter and just stops and just says, look at you. So, of course, she looks up, and it's Paul McCartney, you know.
Wow.
And I had to just compose myself, you know, because I was going to faint.
Uh-huh.
So he pinches her cheek, and he says, you look beautiful tonight. And she's like, thank you. And then, of course, he looks up at me, and I'm like, hi, Paul. He shakes my hand. I just told him I loved him, and that was it. And it was just one of those moments where, like, I remember Mike telling me a story that when he met Paul,
yeah,
it was you and your daughter.
Exactly.
And it was the same exact thing. Like you said, he winked at her and everything. And it was just like, you know, in that Paul mode.
Yeah.
That's so fun. I just told Charlie this story a couple of days ago. It's like the funniest thing, when I met Paul last year, I had like a similar experience. That there's a big running joke in my family that when my mom and dad saw the Beatles at Shea Stadium back in the 60s. I think I told you this story, Chris, but
yeah.
It's funny because it ties in with Charlie's story. It's like my mom always said that Paul McCartney like looked at her and winked at her on his way to the stage. And I would always make fun of her, like, yeah, I'm sure he looked and winked at like 1,000 people on the way to the stage, of course. But then when I finally did meet Paul last year, it was me, him, and my daughter just standing in a circle for 10 minutes talking. And at one point, he just gave my daughter a look dead in the eye, gave her a wink and a big smile. And I said to my daughter, now that is a wink and a smile. Not what my mom got. But it's so funny that he did the same thing to you, Charlie. We got to keep an eye on our girls, man.
He's such a charmer, though. We were just talking earlier, Mike, about how, you know, you hear the cute Beatle and all this stuff. But to this day, like last night on that show, he looked amazing. He knows how to work the camera. He knows exactly what to do. I mean, obviously, it's 50 years of show business experience. But he is still the cute Beatle that just commands the stage. He's on there with Dave Grohl and Nirvana, and you can't even look at those guys. You're looking at Paul. He's not even saying anything.
It's Paul.
You know, there's just such a charisma and a vibe about him. And going back
He looks unbelievable, too.
He does.
Incredible.
You know,
it's funny. Yeah, Chris, me, you, and my kids went and saw him live.
Mm-hmm.
Phoenix. 7 years ago, whatever.
Yeah, in Phoenix.
And it was also a funny thing. I remember me and you saying to each other, oh my God, I can't believe how good he looks. He looks so young. He looks so good. And my daughter looked up at us and was like, really? I was thinking, I can't believe how old he looks. he's pictures of him, you know?
Yeah.
In the Beatles.
It's a little bit different for us in our 40s and somebody that's like 12 years old to define what's old and what's looking good, you know?
Different perspective.
And I also have to say, I am the loser on this team today that I haven't met a Beatle. So I feel – I did meet a Stone, though. I met Keith Richards. So that's not bad, too. That's not bad. But so let's talk about the Beatles. I mean, it's funny because the cool thing about music is when you meet somebody and you find out that you like the same band, it almost makes you closer as friends. And Mike and I were friends for a long time. And I think one of the reasons why we became even better friends is because our love of the Beatles. And then you said, you know who else loves the Beatles? Charlie Benanti loves the Beatles. I was like, really? Like, that's weird. And then suddenly Charlie and I started talking. And then the three of us kind of started this group text thing. Like, my wife has her group text with her friends. My group text is Charlie and Mike. And we just say, hey, did you see the Beatles re-release? You know, our Band on the Run just came out on a box set. What is your...
We're the Fab Three.
We're the Fab Three, that's right.
I like that.
Yeah, exactly. What is your first memory of the Beatles, and what attracted you to them from the start? We'll start with Charlie on that.
Wow. I will tell you this. I have four older sisters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the youngest. So there was music in the house all the time. And, of course, in the 60s.
Yeah.
What's it going to be?
That's right.
It's going to be the Beatles because they just took a hold of everybody, and there was you had no choice but to love the Beatles. Anyway, I was really young when this whole thing happened, and Ed Sullivan, you know, I was a little kid.
What year were you born?
I was 62.
Okay, so you're really young, yeah.
Yeah. So I was exposed to that, and then... that was it. The Beatles were it for me. I don't think I had a choice. And my mom and my sisters always tell this funny story. There's this little area where we lived called Westchester Square, and that was the place where you would go to Woolworths. There's the movie theater. There's everything. And it's funny because Tempesta lived right over there, too. And we always talk about that area. Back then they were playing A Hard Day's Night and Help together.
Okay.
Because Help had just come out and it was a double feature. So my mom took me to see Help and A Hard Day's Night, and they had to stay there twice. Because not only did they sit through Help and A Hard Day's Night once, I had to sit through it again. So my mother was there till like 8, 9 o'clock at night watching Beatle movies because I wouldn't leave. And they always tell that story. So that's my earliest, you know, and in that same area when I was old enough to, like, you know, you buy your first record.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the White Album at Woolworths, and that was it.
It's
always been the Beatles.
Yeah.
It's just always been. And the majority of the people in that arena last night, I would say, probably if you trace it back to their first experience, it's always going to come back to the Beatles at some point. And all of us, me,
absolutely,
you, Mike, it's always going to go back to the Beatles, because if it wasn't for the Beatles, I don't think popular music would be popular music.
Well, I mean, and then that's
any
whole,
music.
Any music.
Well, exactly. Even to this day, it's still ahead of its time, which is what blows my mind. Mike, what was your first experience with the Beatles?
Well, it's funny, but there was a definite synergy between me and the Beatles, because the day I was born April 20th, 1967. That was the very day that the Beatles put the final touches on Sgt. Pepper. That was the day they wrapped Sgt. Pepper.
Really?
So it's crazy. And then the album came out like 6 weeks later. But I was exposed to them from my dad, who was a Beatles fanatic like we are. And literally from day one, he was just feeding me the Beatles. And as I was born in 67, I only caught the tail end. But I remember, you know, the albums when they came out. I remember the White Album when it came out. I remember Abbey Road when it came out and Let It Be. You know, those last couple. I remember going to see Yellow Submarine in the theaters when I was like, you know, a year or two old or whatever, you know. And then I went and saw George Harrison. George Harrison was my first rock concert.
That's crazy.
In 74.
Awesome.
And then I saw a Wings Over America tour in 76. So, yeah, I mean, literally from the very beginning. And it's funny you bring up the story about going to the movies, Charlie, because I remember my grandfather taking me to see Let It Be. It was playing like a midnight movie or whatever. And, you know, I was only, you know, 6, 7 years old at the time, and he took me to a midnight movie, and the poor old guy was sitting there in the theater till 2 a.m. with me watching Let It Be. But, yeah, I mean, literally, I remember sitting. I have a great picture of myself sitting at a Mickey Mouse record player, you know, with a Beatles 45. You can see the green apple right there on the label.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I'm sitting there, like, eating a bowl of cereal at you know, 8 months old or whatever, you know?
You know what's funny is that my dad took me to see a double feature in Winnipeg. It wasn't a late night thing, but it was Yellow Submarine and Let It Be in about 1980. I was born in 1970, and I never saw Let It Be again until you gave me the bootleg of it, Mike, because, of course, they didn't release it at all. But I was born November 9th, 1970. I remember when I was a kid, I was really sad because the Beatles had broken up like in March, officially, of 70. And I was like, man, I was never officially alive when the Beatles were together. That used to bum me out so bad. But it was the same for me. My dad had a bunch of 8-tracks. Which is funny because we were talking in one of our group texts that Mike is now into 8-tracks.
Yeah.
But he had Let It Be. And I just remember looking at the cover of it. It was so cool, just the 4 pictures. And something about it, like you could tell there was like 4 distinct personalities because other bands didn't really have that. Like that my dad had record collection. Like the Beach Boys, it might be like a group shot or something. But the 4 individual faces just really intrigued me. And then I got super into the Beatles right off the bat, like became a fanatic. At about 8, like reading books and not just, oh, I like the Beatles. Like I knew everything about the Beatles. And then when I got into junior high school or maybe a little bit late elementary, it wasn't cool to like the Beatles at that point in time.
There was a period.
You know, early 80s, the Beatles were not cool. And everyone thought I was a nerd because I had my own Beatles shirt made and everybody was listening to like Loverboy and the Little River Band and this sort of thing. And then when I got into junior high school, all the girls were wearing Aussie shirts and, you know, Sabbath shirts and Maiden shirts and Priest shirts. And I thought, if I'm ever going to talk to a girl and get a date, maybe I should check out one of these metal bands. So I bought Blizzard of Oz. It was my first metal tape that I bought. And I put it on. And of course, song 3 is Goodbye to Romance, which is total Beatles song. And that's when I realized what you were saying, Mike, is that everything goes back to the Beatles. Even Ozzy, who was the coolest guy at the time, was still a huge Beatles fanatic.
Right.
You know, and you can tell that from the start. But, you know, it's interesting because we were reading, you know, it's the 50-year anniversary of the Beatles coming to America and just how revolutionary it was. You haven't read the Rolling Stone article, but you know everything about the Beatles anyways. Charlie and I have read it. 50 years later, just the fact that it's still so massive in the pop culture eye to the fact that they're, you know, the Grammys last night was the Beatles show. You know, basically, it was all about the Beatles. Like, the Stones were nominated for something, and no one even gave a peep. It was all Beatles, Beatles, Beatles. What do you think it is about that show, that time, that that 1964, February 9th? You know, we weren't there, but we've read about it and studied it. What are your thoughts on that? And then what started off this huge revolution, so to speak?
Well, I think it's because they did everything first, starters. You know, they were the first band to do all these things, you know, whether it be, you know, taking over America by storm and taking over every country they went to by storm, but also the music they wrote, and probably most importantly, you know, obviously it's all about the music.
Mm-hmm.
And no bands were making records the way they were, you know, back then. Back before the Beatles, it was all, you know, by the numbers, kind of 1-4-5 blues progressions. It was all, you know, the
doo-wop
pop
stuff,
like Bobby Darin or whatever, or you had, you know, the Beach Boys, and or you had your Elvises and Chuck Berrys. But, you know, the Beatles exploded on the scene because it was like this big pop culture, you know, explosion. But then once you started listening to the songs, they were writing chord changes and progressions and melodies and harmonies that mm-hmm. broke the mold and were doing things that nobody had done. And then, you know, once you got us around 65, 66, 67, they were doing studio techniques and things like that and production techniques that nobody had ever heard of. Backwards guitars and, you know,
splitting the tracks
and multi-tracking the drumming and multi-tracking all the other instruments. And so, you know, everything they did was a first.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you could only ever have a band that's like that once in history, and they were it. And they were, you know, on every level, breaking new ground and doing things that hadn't ever been done.
Mm-hmm. But I also think the time that they came out was perfect, especially in America, because you just had, you know, the Kennedy mm-hmm. assassination. So America as a whole was still mourning what had happened, and then the Beatles came and kind of washed over that and mm-hmm. just put smiles on people's faces, you know. And the one thing about the Beatles that I always loved about them is because I loved like the Marx Brothers and the comedy from back mm-hmm. then, and the Beatles were kind of similar to that. Remember, the one thing about the Beatles is like not one of them, you couldn't really take one of them and that was the star. The four of them always
yes.
had something good about them.
Yeah.
And they were great on camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they would just come out with these kind of, either John would be a sarcastic thing or George would call his haircut Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just
mm-hmm.
little things like that. Like, they were perfect.
Yeah.
It's almost like they were actors. Like, you know what I mean?
They were, Mick Jagger called them the four-headed monster. And that's what they were like, because, you know, they came to America and it was a lot like what's going on right now with One Direction. I know. I mean, your daughter is probably the similar age as mine, Charlie. I know yours is a little bit older, Mike. But One Direction, I mean, they don't play their own instruments and stuff, but everybody hates them except for their fans, and their fans are insane.
I don't hate them, by the
way. I'm going to go see them in concert in October, so I have to like them. But I mean... people, like, you get it because we're musicians, we understand the hook, but my point is you got these guys coming from England and, you know, it's a boy band, it's kiddie music, as crazy as it sounds now, people thought the same about the Beatles.
They were
at
scared
that point
of them
in time.
Too.
Because they were hippies, if you look at the time, their hair was super long. Four guys from England that had this accent, and also you couldn't break them down. Like, people came there at that first press conference to bury them, and the Beatles were so good and stuck together and so sarcastic and witty and cheeky, you couldn't get them.
Couldn't get them.
Like you said, how do you find America? Turn left at Greenland.
Yeah.
And what do you call that haircut? Call it Arthur. You know, that's another reason why I think they ingratiated themselves with their haters, because they were so smart and clever in
and
what
charming.
They were doing and charming. Exactly. Even till last night, talking about McCartney being so charming.
Exactly.
You know, they had never seen anything like that before.
But prior to the Beatles, what did we have? You had solo artists. You had basically
Elvis.
You had Elvis, and before Elvis, you had Sinatra, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, and the one cool thing about the Beatles is that they loved all that stuff.
Uh huh.
You never heard them say a bad thing about anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So, going back to that, going back to the 60s, I guess, you know, you had, you know, we landed on the moon,
mm-hmm.
and then you had the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the 60s, and you had the assassination of
JFK,
Kennedy,
that's right?
So you have these historic things that happen, and, you know, the Beatles, I think, just, they made people happy again
mm-hmm.
in America, especially. Overseas, it was happening, you know what I mean?
It was happening way before it happened in America.
And they just did it, and they did it first, like Mike said. And they were just, they weren't a one-hit wonder. They just followed the next record up with something great, and then something great. And then they changed
and always
the course
changing.
Of history.
Yeah, always changing.
Always.
You know, it was funny, once again, reading that Rolling Stone article, talking about how Brian Epstein arranged for them to be on Sullivan for less money. They said that Elvis got paid $50,000 to do the Sullivan show. He allowed them to do it for $10,000, but insisted that they had three shows where they were the main event of the show, the headliner.
Which is great.
Genius. How much of the success of the Beatles do you attribute to Brian Epstein, Mike?
Well, I think Brian Epstein is surely responsible for all of those kind of business moves, and he obviously was the one that blew them up, because before Brian came along, they were just playing, you know, the Hamburg clubs for, you know, 365 nights a year, and you know, in their leather jackets, and of course that's where they honed their skills and learned their chops and became a great, great, great band. Mm-hmm. But once Brian Epstein got a hold of them, that's, you know, he got their record deal. He put them in the studio. He was the one that sold them to the world. So I think he was a genius. And when you look at, you know, I don't think the Beatles made a wrong move until Magical Mystery Tour. And I love Magical Mystery Tour. But in the public eye, that was their first, like, real flop.
Yeah.
And that was the very first thing they did with that Brian Epstein. So there's something to be said for that. Mm-hmm. You know, and then they created, after Brian, they created Apple Records, which ultimately came crushing down, and ultimately all their business affairs fell apart, and they ultimately broke up and ended up in this sea of lawsuits. So mm-hmm. there's something to be said for Brian Epstein holding it all together. I think Brian was very much the fifth Beatle on a business level, the same way that George Martin was the fifth Beatle on mm-hmm. a creative level in the studio.
What do you think, Charlie?
I totally agree with
him. Yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's much like Bill O'Coin and Kiss. He was able to harness this raw power and this raw energy and made them do some things that they didn't want to do. I mean, we all know the story that John Lennon did not want to wear a suit and tie and would always unbutton his top button of his collar, et cetera, et cetera. But once again, you know, you saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show, or you saw them on the Grammys, the charm was there. And, you know, another thing that I thought was really interesting in that Rolling Stone article, it was saying that that McCartney, the first night, was almost the star of the show because his vocals were higher in the mix. You couldn't really hear Lennon, and Paul was playing to the camera,
right.
Whereas John and George were playing to the arena.
Yeah.
And it's such an amazing trick. It's something that, you know, if you've ever done live shows, which we've all done, or even in wrestling, you play to the camera because the crowd is there. That's fine. But you're dealing with the millions at home. And it seems that Paul just had this instinct to do that. Why would they know? Or why wouldn't George and John know? But Paul knew and became kind of like the star of the band right off the bat from that first performance.
But I think even then, everybody had a favorite Beatle. I mean, immediately you saw girls in the audience, I like Ringo, I like George, you know, and they were the sort of band, you know, where, like you said earlier, you know, for the first time ever, you had four distinct personalities. You know, you had the cute one, the smart one, the quiet one, and the funny one. And, you know, that was the first time that had ever happened. And, you know, even though Paul was the charmer and maybe got the attention at the beginning, I think, you know, they established right from the get-go that John was the leader, mm-hmm. you know, and they were, you know, they always acknowledged him as that in the early days. And, you know, and Ringo was the one in A Hard Day's Night where they kind of set him apart and made him, gave him a star role in terms of, you know, setting him apart in terms of the storyline and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that they all really got distinct attention in different areas, you know, and I think to this day, you know, you have your, you know, everybody's got a different favorite Beatle.
Well, and like we were talking about, Mick said it was the four-headed monster, and every guy had a personality. Every guy was important. It makes me laugh when people say, oh, you know, Ringo's a terrible drummer or whatever. Without Ringo, that band wouldn't have been the same. He was an integral part of what that band was doing. And it's a funny story. You talk about Hard Day's Night, and when Ringo kind of had his little walk along the river and had the big solo part, apparently that was because the other guys were so hungover they didn't make it to set on time. So they just had Ringo, and he was just walking around, so they gave him some solo time.
Oh, I thought he was the one hungover.
Yeah.
No, but the other guys didn't show up.
I thought Ringo was
the... That's the famous line from the White Album sessions.
What's that?
I thought he was the one. Where? what was it? When I think George left the session. George left the band.
No, yeah, that's
Ringo
right. Yeah,
the,
yeah.
I Ringo thought left the band for a few days, and And he was saying, oh, I was feeling all alone, like you guys, you know, it's all the three of you.
I thought it was you.
Yeah, I thought it was you.
And they all thought it was the same thing with the other person.
I love that, too, when we're talking about, you know, the quiet beetle and the cute beetle. And meanwhile, you know, once again, talking about what Jimmy Nicol was saying when he toured with the Beatles about how insane all of them were how, like, they're all just, like, total sluts. And, you know, George was the quiet beetle, my ass. He was completely crazy. Yeah. And, I mean, just think about that, too. I mean, the sexual revolution was happening at the time. And here you have four, you know, cute guys from England with the accents and the hair. They must have had girls every single night, dozens, any girl you could ask for.
So many Beatle babies.
At night with them just getting chased around. And you know, you see the pictures and the videos of them being locked in their hotel rooms, and I can't even imagine. I mean, and you know, you hear the stories of them starting in Hamburg and the Reeperbahn. I'm sure, you know, all three of us have been to Hamburg and what it's like there in the red light district. That's where they lived
right.
for a couple of years. I can't even imagine, you know,
how it
all began for them.
It is surprising that there's not more people that have come out and said, you know, John Lennon's my father. Or,
yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You know, like there has to be.
Beatle babies everywhere.
Yeah. Norm. John Lennon is Norm's father. Our boss here today is looking through the window.
Charlie, you were born in, what did you say, 62?
Yeah. Sorry.
Cam.
Hey, Mike, I tell you what, McCartney.
Yeah, I'm right on the timeline.
McCartney winked at your mom. You never know. He might have flew her in. Might have flew her in at some point in time. You are the cute member of Transatlantic. I'll tell you that. We'll be right back with more Talk is Jericho. Just got to give a little love to our sponsors, our Sexy Beast sponsors. Having a great time here talking about the Beatles, the 50th anniversary of them coming to America with Charlie Benanti and Mike Portnoy right here. LegalZoom can help you with two things. Number one, getting your life organized. And number two, starting a business. Getting your life organized starts with a last will and testament or a living trust from LegalZoom. Do you have one? Because if you don't, you need it. It's very important to have a last will and testament. You need it so you can protect your family and your assets and get peace of mind in the process. And for those of you starting a new business this year, LegalZoom can save you a ton of time and money. They've helped start over 1 million businesses. 1 million businesses. That's a lot of businesses. And LegalZoom obviously gets the job done right. That track record speaks for itself. That's probably why 9 out of 10 customers who use them end up referring LegalZoom to their family and friends. I'm referring them to you. I've used LegalZoom and it works. LegalZoom's personalized, very affordable protection has also earned them an A+ by the Better Business Bureau. LegalZoom's step-by-step process was created by a team of experts in law and technology. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but can connect you with a third-party attorney and provides you with self-help services. So, for special savings, Jerichoholics, enter my name, Chris. That's C-H-R-I-S in the referral box at checkout. I'm telling you right now, don't let another day go by before you take care of these things for your family and business. Go to LegalZoom.com for help with everything from wills to business formation, trademark applications, powers of attorney, and even bankruptcy help. That's LegalZoom.com and enter Chris at checkout.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Talk is Jericho.
Welcome back to Talk is Jericho, having a great conversation. And we've sussed out that Mike might actually be a Beatle baby. There's a chance. We're not sure. But let's talk about the diversity of the Beatles. And once again, we mentioned it earlier about how, I mean, they lasted for 7 years, 8 years tops, maybe. And completely, in my opinion, almost invented every genre of rock and roll, whether you're doing, you know, they started with the early days with the harmonic kind of, you know, the pop music. Then they created, I mean, there's ska music, there's weird Frank Zappa type stuff, there's Mr. Bungle type stuff, there's heavy metal. There's ragtime type music. It's like they did everything, but it always fit within the Beatles umbrella. That's another thing that's amazing after 8 years with all the different styles of music that they did.
I mean, the White Album is a perfect example. I mean, if you look at the diversity and the styles that are on the White Album, it's ridiculous. It's like it was the first heavy metal song, and it's the first lullaby, and literally from song to song to song on the White Album, you're pretty much covering the entire spectrum of music, and nobody does that, you know?
No, nobody could.
No, it's like we already said before, it's just they broke the mold and created everything in its wake.
But not only did they what was in the sleeve of those of that was amazing, but also every cover that they did became just iconic. Mm-hmm. And I mean, who puts a white
right at the time,
at
especially
the time,
yeah,
with just the Beatle logo on, mm-hmm. But if you think about it, like Revolver, you could just stare at their. I remember just staring at their covers, mm-hmm. and just be like, "What is this?" Mm-hmm.
Looking at all the different little pictures on the cover of it.
I think Sgt. Pepper, was the first gatefold album, and I think it was also the first album to have lyrics included as well.
Little treats. Like, I remember there was a mustache in there, and there was a badge in there. Yeah. Kiss did that in the 70s, but nobody had done that in the 60s.
And I love the, who they wanted to be featured on Sgt. Pepper on the cover, and I think Mae West didn't want to be considered in the Lonely Hearts Club Band, come on, it's the Beatles, but there's so many things on that cover, like the hand behind Paul, because that was the whole Paul is dead thing that started. This is such a trippy thing, the way a little thing with them went so long,
Paul is dead?
Paul is dead.
It almost makes me think that, I think they're so genius and maybe a little bit bored. I almost think that they were planting those clues themselves, because there's so many of them. And, people are crazy, fans are nuts, and I'm sure they could find clues where there are none. But it wouldn't surprise me after a while if they just started doing it just to screw with people's heads because they were bored and too smart.
But it went on.
You know what that means, then? That means who Charlie met last night at the Grammys actually really wasn't Paul.
That's why he looks so good.
You saw him met Paul, man.
What was his name? Fall?
I can't remember exactly.
It was
Neil Innes.
Speaking of that, I'm watching Paul do his song last night, and I like that song.
It's a good tune,
and it totally reminds me of a Ruddle song, because they do that same part. O-U-T. You know what I'm saying?
Out. Yeah.
I was like,
Well, O-U-T spells out dates back to the Christmas Time Is Here Again, one of the Christmas records from the 60s.
Exactly. Christmas
Time. O-U-T spells out. I mean, that's literally from...
The Ruddles, for those who don't know, is in the mid-70s, some dudes from Monty Python did a Beatles spoof, and they called it The Ruddles. And it was kind of like an original Spinal Tap. Very, very funny, very clever. And the more you watched it, the more you saw.
Well, Harrison financed
it. That's right. Yeah, it was a handmade film.
He loved it.
Yeah.
Well, George Harrison was in it.
Yeah,
he was the interviewer outside of Ruddle Corps when they were robbing the place.
Yeah.
Him and Ron Wood were doing an interview.
What did you guys think of the Scorsese Living in the Material World, the George Harrison documentary?
I loved it.
I thought it was amazing. And it, in some ways, it made George my favorite Beatle after seeing that.
Well, I think it was great that George got his due, because... when John died, when Lennon was killed, it was as monumental as when Kennedy was killed.
Yes.
I mean, it literally the entire earth stood still. And rightly so, because unbelievable and shocking. But when George passed away, it was almost like, oh, George Harrison died. People were like, he died. It's not like anybody should be more important than anybody else. But, I mean, it was almost kind of sad that George's passing kind of went not unnoticed, but it was really not acknowledged.
It was just another famous person passing away, basically.
Right, but do you think it was because of the way or the timing?
For John?
For John? You know what I mean? The way his was so, his life was taken.
Yeah.
Right.
And the irony of the guy, give peace a chance, and he gets murdered.
And he gets murdered.
But also, that was the end of the innocence. That was really the end of, the 60s is when John was assassinated, for sure. I think another thing was that how underplayed the fact that George was almost assassinated.
Correct.
Yeah. That's what blew my mind. That hardly got
just
any
prior,
press.
Just prior to that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that a Beatle could still be assaulted in that manner. Like, you think that after John was assassinated, he would have had a steel gate.
But he didn't want to live like that.
No, he didn't.
Look, if Charlie could knock off Ringo's glasses,
that's true. Charlie almost assassinated Ringo last night. That's true.
Oh, my goodness.
But, it was, like you said, it gave George a spotlight and also showed just how deep he was, because he kind of got a little bit of the reputation for being like the real hippie, the Indian guy, the guy who brought, mysticism and spiritual. And he was, but I like the stories too, where it's like he was just as crazy as everyone else. He loved girls. His wife was basically saying that, I know that George used to mess around on me, but it's either get divorced or not. And, he was still a guy, and he was still a rocker,
I think the thing about George, George, the Beatles were the greatest thing, and they were all cool, but I don't know. I had this thing about George that I thought George was secretly, like, the coolest Beatle.
To be
honest with you.
For why? Why do you say that?
I hear you.
Because George was just like, I'm here, I'm going to let you guys do your thing. Mm-hmm. But then I'm going to hit you with some stuff that is going to be like...
Right. Like towards the end when he got it together.
When he got his stuff together. And he, like one of my favorite records is, of course, All Things Must Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And those are Beatles songs.
And there's three albums worth.
But, George was friends with a lot of cool musicians who really liked George.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean?
Yeah. He seemed like... out of the three, main guys, he did not have as much of an ego as Paul, and maybe not as crazy as John.
I always viewed it that, so the Beatles are having a party, mm-hmm. right, let's say, and all the cool people are coming in, they're like, is George here?
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I mean?
Where's George at?
Yeah, George's table is over there. And then you'd see all the kind of...
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think, too, I always say this, is that, George Harrison, legendary player, amazing songwriter, very charismatic, but his only problem was he was in a band with the two best songwriters of all time. He had no chance. He was number three no matter what he did. And I also think, just let me finish, Charlie, I also think that he came in as the young guy, and within the chemistry of the band, he was always seen as the little George.
But he had to catch up to their
speed. That's right, he did.
Once he caught up, he was awesome.
Yes.
Let's face it. Those songs that he did later on in the latter part of the Beatles were better than a lot of those.
You could take the three of Sun, Here Comes the Sun,
Beautiful,
Something, and Gently, Gently Weeps.
Taxman, dude.
But you could take those three and put them up against any late era Paul and John. But the point is, though, George was never going to get more than one or two songs on a record, no matter what kind of stuff he was
possible.
Well, I think that's why All Things Must Pass was such a brilliant record, because like Charlie said, those were Beatles songs.
Yeah.
Those were the songs he was accumulating all those years when he was only getting, one or two songs per album.
He
was writing, My Sweet Lord and
Wawa, and It's a Pity, and Beware of Darkness.
Beware of Darkness, that album, every song on that album is an amazing song.
Now, what if those songs got the Beatle treatment?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Carney bass lines. There's some outtakes of him doing, like, Not Guilty during White Album sessions, and a few of those songs. And, I don't know. There was something that when he put out All Things Must Pass, I think that was probably the most successful of the four first Beatles.
But what's funny, Mike? Mm-hmm. You know what the biggest seller was of the first four Beatles Souls records? Ringo's.
Right.
No.
Yes. Look
really?
It up.
Wow.
Yeah. It's crazy. Wow. It's crazy.
It was a big radio song.
Well, yeah. It was. He had, I think maybe his came out first or something.
One more thing about George. My favorite George tribute is the concert for George. Did you see that?
Yes.
Oh, that's incredible.
Amazing.
The fact that Clapton and Dylan and Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty and Paul and Ringo, and it really was that was the first time after his death where I felt, okay, he's really getting his due, and that was an incredible tribute to him, that whole concert.
I love that story too about how, and we're going back to how George is always kind of seen as little George by John and Paul, is that he came in with While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and they didn't want to record it. They didn't like it. So George comes in the next day with Eric Clapton because he knew they'd be on their best behavior and not want to insult Clapton. And that's how he got that song recorded. And that's actually Clapton playing the solo on that record, which a lot of people don't know. And I just love that concept that he actually, George was smart enough to know that, okay, they don't want to play my song. I'll bring Clapton in. That'll shut him up.
I'll bring this guy in. But, you know, that's there's something that I've always wondered about the Beatles throughout their recording history. How did George feel when it was like, Paul's going to do this lead? You know what I mean?
Oh. Like Taxman.
Yeah, Taxman.
Yeah. So it's like, what is George, like George, you know, he sits back and goes, okay, well, you do
he
it.
He saw his reaction and let it be.
And let it be,
It's plain as day and let it be. He just says, I'll play what you want me to play, or I won't play anything at all. You know, I think he was just that kind of guy.
Whatever pleases you.
Whatever
I also think
you.
Too that McCartney really started taking over. The I don't know if you call it management, but the direction of the band. At that point, you can tell and let it be, which is why they didn't release it for so long, because it was kind of sad, and you could just see them getting on each other's nerves.
But do you think? Okay, because I used to live by that Mark Lewisohn book. That was the Bible, the Beatles Bible to me. The recording sessions of the Beatles. Okay, so I would. I reference that book, and I would always, you know, tell the guys in the band, you gotta see, this book is the greatest book. Anyway, McCartney used to live like right around the corner from the studio, so he would be the first one to show up. And those guys sometimes wouldn't even show up to sessions, apparently. So do you think it got to be a point where McCartney is like, they're not here, I just want to do this, you know what I mean?
Probably, yeah, absolutely.
I get that. I mean, I watched Let It Be recently, and it's obvious when you watch that movie that Paul was driving the ship at that point. I think John was wrapped up in Yoko, and he could care less. And, you know, and Paul, you know, Brian Epstein wasn't around anymore, and George Martin wasn't even on that session. So Paul was driving the ship. And, you know, all three of us are in bands. You know how it is. You know what the dynamics are like. And,
yeah.
Sometimes somebody's got to grab hold of the reins and push things forward. And I don't think
or nothing
blame,
gets done.
I also can't blame Paul for that. I think I watched Let It Be, and a lot of people I know get the reaction like, oh my God, Paul's being a dick or he's being a dictator.
I never yet.
I watched Let It Be, and it's like, you know what? Paul's the only one that seems to be giving a shit and driving the band forward and trying. He was the one that said, look, let's get back to basics. Let's play on the rooftop. He was the one that said, let's strip things down and write as a band together again. He was doing everything he could to hold it together.
But do you think at that time, because if you watch Let It Be, all of them just look like done.
Yeah, they're over it.
Just done. Yeah. Like, they aged so much.
That was only like 5 years.
And it was
like
only
five or six years.
I know, it's crazy, right?
And it looks like they just aged and they were just over it. And I really think maybe drugs had a lot to do with that breakup and just the work ethic.
You know what? I think that, too. The fact that they were on a schedule of a record every 6 months for the first, you know, 6 years of their career. I think, and this to me is why the Beatles broke up. I don't blame it on Yoko. I don't blame it on any of these things. I think it's the same story that happened in the Police. Stuart Copeland started this band, brought in this kid to play in his band. Suddenly the kid, whose name is Sting, ends up being a virtuoso, crazy, freak musician who writes, you know, amazing songs in his sleep and can play every instrument in 5 minutes. Same thing with the Beatles. John brings in this kid, Paul, who can write songs. And then suddenly Paul starts becoming bigger than John. And by the time the late 60s comes around, Paul is killing John in everything. I think John even said, listen, you know, Paul's writing 3 great songs a day. Give me a couple seconds to try and write one. Like, you're too good. And I think John started pulling back with that rebellious attitude. I think that's why he brought Yoko in, because he knew it pissed Paul off.
I think they had achieved so much so quickly.
Yes, so young.
That by 69... You know, by 1969, what was left? And I think that's they had done it all, you know. And they, you know, John was with Yoko, and Paul had met Linda, and you know, everybody had their wives, and they all wanted to, you know, what's next? What do you do at that point? And I think they all just started to feel the burn. And I mean, my God, it was so quick. If you look from 63 to 70, that's only 7 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the course. You know, most bands these days will make maybe one or two albums in that course of time. They literally put out, you know, 12 or 13.
Anthrax did one record in 10 years.
It took us 8 years, actually, to make a record.
Yeah.
But, you know, you brought up a good point about that, you know, how it's so much so soon and just how it worked for those guys. But I also think if Brian Epstein was there at the time, he may have said, why don't the four of you go do your own individual records, okay?
Uh-huh.
Get that out of your system, you know? Take some time away from each other. Then let's come back and do a Beatle record. And I think maybe they would have probably, you know, lasted.
Right. It's the same thing that happened with Kiss in 78. That's why they did those solo records. Because I think another thing, too, is that George was probably thinking, screw this. Like, I'm putting out these amazing songs, and I got 30 more in my, you know, in my bag. So, and because George was the one that didn't want to come back and play live as well. I think George had kind of mentally checked out too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is an interesting concept when you think about how much they achieved in such a short period of time. And it was bound to explode. It's just interesting. Do you think, had John not been assassinated, that they would have got back together at some point?
Definitely.
Oh, absolutely.
It almost happened.
The three of them did during the anthology sessions. You know, they put together Real Love and Free as a Bird, and they did all the interviews together. They, you know, there's no way that they wouldn't have. Plus, I think Lorne Michaels made that offer to them for what, $3,000?
$3,000.
He probably would have upped the ante to maybe $5,000 by now. So yeah, it would have happened.
Well, you know, it did kind of happen at which was Lennon's last weekend.
Yes. Now, we just found out about this a couple years ago, which blew my mind, which was explained.
They did record stuff, him and Paul, but I've never heard it.
But wasn't it like some kind of a drunken session with, like, you know, Harry Nilsson and Stevie Wonder, and they're all just, like, apparently it's not very good.
Right, but it could
have. They were together.
It could have been the spark that, I miss you.
Well, yeah, yeah. Because the other rumor was that night when they did make the offer on Saturday Night Live, that Paul and John were actually together and were going to go into the studio and show up. Did you guys ever hear that one?
Yeah, I heard that.
And either they couldn't catch a cab.
There's a great famous picture of Paul and John sitting at a pool sometime around that period, you know, probably mid to late 70s. And that was the last photo of them together. But there's no question that they would have absolutely gotten together for something. You know, the anthology was amazing. I mean, it's sad that John wasn't there for that, but man, even just seeing the three of them
reminisce
together in the studio and making music together was goosebumps, you know.
I'd love to see, and we've talked about this for a while, I'd love to have Ringo and Paul just get in a room for, you know, a week, go in for 5 hours a day for a week and just film it. You know, we saw the anthology, but this is the end. You know, they're at the end of their careers, their lives possibly. But just, you know, they're the only two left. Like, what stories could they tell that have never been told? I'm sure there's thousands of them. It'd be cool to have them kind of get together and do that, but I don't know if they ever would. You know, it seems like they're comfortable and happy, but it doesn't seem like they're really close buddies anymore.
No, it's a shame. I mean, or to do a tour together, like what they did last night. You know, but basically Ringo, when I say last night, I mean on the Grammys,
yeah.
You know, do something like that. Basically, Ringo was just sitting in with Paul's band. Well, do that. I mean, Paul's already doing a set list that's 80% Beatles. So, you know, take Ringo out with him. I mean, Ringo's already out doing the All-Star Band. I mean, so it's not like he doesn't want the tour. I mean, it would be a monumental thing that everybody in the world would love to see. And to take it a step further, and I know the three of us have already dreamt about this, but do something like with Danny Harrison and Julian Lennon or Sean Lennon. You know, include those guys.
Get Clapton in there, too. I mean, Clapton is the heir apparent to George and always. You know, they could do a really cool thing, but I don't think Paul wants to. I think Paul's happy being Paul and doing the business he is. But like you said, you could get Ringo in there because, let's be honest, they didn't show Abe Laboriel on camera last night. But
Which was weird.
Yeah, because I think
he was in the dark.
They wanted people to think it was Ringo playing, but they're showing close-ups of him doing a 4-4 beat, and there's these monstrous fills coming from his right.
It's Abe doing it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was kind of misleading, I must say, because they built up this excitement, two Beatles, you know. So I don't know if maybe Paul said, no, I want to do my own song.
I'm sure he did.
Because you have Ringo up there, and to me, the finale of that night would have been Paul and Ringo, a little help from my friends, doing this song, doing that song. That, to me, would have been...
Well, and they still might do that, though, because they have this Grammy special February 9th, and Paul and Ringo are going to be there. Maybe they'll do something.
That's possible.
But I don't
maybe
know
if... Maybe they saved it.
I don't know if Paul wants to. I don't
know if
he wants
to. You know
what I mean?
I
think Paul's so huge on his own, he might consider it a step backwards, you know?
Yeah, but look at what Paul plays live. I mean, we've all seen Paul on his recent tours, and he's amazing. He's, he's
sounds great.
And putting on... the ultimate Beatles show, but he's still playing 80% Beatles songs.
That's true. And obscure stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. And he's obviously not shy to acknowledge the Beatles. He's obviously embracing it. So just go all the way.
Just do it.
Go just one last time for all of us, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Because like you said, time is running out. Time also kind of running out on our show. Let's end it with favorite album and favorite song. On this day, I know you can't really pick a favorite like for life, but what do you think, Mike? Favorite Beatles record?
It's impossible to pick, but Guns Ahead, I always go back to Sgt. Pepper just because that was the groundbreaker on every level. So I don't know. That's the one I always come back to when I have to ultimately pick one.
Favorite Beatles song, obscure Beatles song?
Well, if you go for an obscure one, I mean, I love like Happiness is a Warm Gun, you know, if you want to pick a deep track. But, you know, the greats are the greats, you know, A Day in the Life, Strawberry Fields, I Am the Walrus, you know, those are the greats of all
time. You know, it's funny, we all go, well, I haven't even asked Charlie yet, but we always talk about, you know, the greats are being those late periods, but I heard, I'm Happy Just to Dance with You this morning.
Oh, awesome.
The harmonies on that song are insane. Like every song is so good in the different eras that they had. Like you could throw any Beatles song with maybe the exception of Act Naturally or something like that, and I could you could make a case for it being the best. Charlie, favorite? Yeah.
Well, it's funny because before we came out here to me and my daughter watched Help.
Yeah.
And she's never seen Help.
Mm-hmm.
So. It's funny because to see her watching the movie and asking me questions about it, like, did that really happen? Did they really try and kill Ringo because of the ring? And then she referred to Paul last night as the cute Beetle, which was funny.
That's great.
And then Ringo, he's up. Yeah. But anyway, Help to me was the record that's it. We're changing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The song Help alone
mm-hmm.
is a cry. You know, Lennon, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And the beauty of that song is it's desperate, but it's such a great song. You hear it, it cheers you up.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, help me.
Mm-hmm.
I need help by the way.
Yeah.
You know? And to me, Help was the record that was a moment where the Beatles changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to say Help is my favorite Beatle record, but I would have to say Revolver is my favorite Beatle record.
Gotcha.
It's got so many weird things on it. And Tomorrow Never Knows is that song.
Yeah, that's the one that crossed the gap.
It's that song, dude.
Yeah.
That's a trippy song.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably drug-induced, but whatever.
Probably.
Yeah.
There's actually a really poignant scene. I don't know if either of you guys watch Mad Men, but a couple seasons ago.
Yeah.
You know, Mad Men, to me, is the ultimate time capsule for the 60s. And I always wondered, well, you know, you could actually, throughout the show, you see the history of the Beatles on Mad Men. You see, like, when they arrived in America, and when they played Chase Stadium. And there was a real poignant moment where Don Draper's being given Revolver by his girlfriend, his new wife, the young, hot new wife. And he puts on Tomorrow Never Knows. The needle drops, and Tomorrow Never Knows begins. And you could just sense, like, time changing. That, to me, Tomorrow Never Knows was when the psychedelic era began.
Yeah.
And and it was a real poignant moment of Mad Men that he actually, like, lifted the needle halfway through the song. He couldn't even listen to it.
Yeah,
he couldn't relate to that.
He couldn't relate to it. He couldn't handle it.
Showing the line and showing where he stood on the fence.
But that is...
That song was really the line in the sand.
I also just love, you know, make me sound like I'm on top of a mountain chanting in front of a thousand Dalai Lamas or whatever. It's like, okay,
do that.
Swing a microphone from the ceiling. Let's see what we can do.
But the thing that we haven't even talked about, and I know this could go on forever, but the there was this thing between the Beatles and the Beach Boys.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I always say this.
A rivalry.
If the Beach Boys didn't do this, the Beatles wouldn't have done that. If the Beatles didn't do that, Beach Boys.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
So Pet Sounds had a big, big effect. And let's face it, there's two things that had a huge effect on the Beatles, and it was the Beach Boys and Bob Dylan.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the Beatles took that and made themselves even better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
they took the influence, Beatalized it, and
Beatalized it. Because let's face it, Brian Wilson was by himself creating all this stuff. He had no one to really bounce off of.
Yeah.
You know, he had his brother, and you know what I mean?
But he was such a genius that he went insane.
He went insane. So I think he has a lot to do with the Beatles sounds.
As far as the influence.
Yeah.
For me, the favorite Beatles record is Abbey Road. I just think all the songs in that, even Maxwell's Silver Hammer with the Moog synthesizer, once again, just never heard this instrument before. Mm-hmm. I Want You, She's So Heavy, that song just speaks to me. I don't know why.
It's beautiful.
And from early days, I think This Boy or That Boy? This Boy, right?
This Boy.
Yeah. The harmonies on that blow in my mind. It's insane.
And the bridge. When John comes out on the bridge of that song, my God.
Oh, it's you know, like we said, it doesn't matter what stage of the Beatles it is. It's pure genius pretty much all the way through. But, guys, you mentioned it, Charlie, that this could go on forever. I would like to do this semi-regularly, have music talk with Mike and Charlie and Chris, because this has been – I can't believe it's been an hour already. It's been just an amazing time. I'm really glad you guys were able to do this. Thank you for coming in.
Thank
the
you.
Studio, Charlie.
I will do it anytime. Breakfast with the Beatles.
Let's do it. Yeah, we'll do late lunch with the Beatles, so Mike doesn't have to get up so early.
Yes, please.
The Fab Three. That's the name. There we go. You'll hear it soon, guys. Thank you so much, man. It's always awesome to talk to you, and you guys are my buds, and I love you like all together now.
Yeah. O-U-T spells out.
Thanks, guys. We'll be right back with more Talk of Jericho right after this.
Woo-hoo. Have you checked out DDP Yoga yet? Huh? If you haven't, you need to. I'm telling you, I've used this for the last 2 years, and it's changed my life. That is no joke. I had very bad back problems, herniated discs, couldn't do anything, and DDP Yoga came in and saved my life. I'm telling you need to try this. It's going to make you healthier and going to make achieving your fitness goals for 2014 even easier. DDP is a proven workout program that has changed the lives of thousands around the world. I am one of them, with a workout plan dedicated to building strength and developing a healthy lifestyle. And now it's being offered to listeners of Talk is Jericho at a discounted rate. So here's what you get with DDP Yoga: a grid chart to plan your workouts, a nutrition guide, and a reference poster with the 12 core positions that make up the DDP Yoga workout. The Max Pack includes 15 workouts that anyone at any level can perform and see results with. You can even download your workouts for exercising on the go. I use DDP wherever I am, in my hotel room, in a dressing room, on the tour bus. It's that easy. No more searching the city to find a gym. No more having to worry about getting in your car and driving around. You can do DDP Yoga wherever you are. So go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho to take advantage of a special offer only available to listeners of my show. That's ddpyoga.com/Jericho, J-E-R-I-C-H-O, to get this deal. But you better do it now, because this special offer is only available for a limited time.
Thanks so much to Charlie Benanti and Mike Portnoy for that amazing conversation about the Beatles. It's really cool to sit down with other fans, uber fans of your favorite bands, and just talk, man. So if you like that segment and you want to hear more from Charlie, Mike, and Chris talking about all things music, let me know. Hit me up on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho. Let's open up the phone lines, take a couple calls at the end of the show, ask me anything that's on your mind. Hey, man, you're on the line. What's your name, man?
My name's Chris. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio.
All right. What's your question? You're on Talk is Jericho. Welcome.
Whew. Awesome. Well, first off, you are the greatest thing to ever entertain me via a television or my computer screen. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just want to know when I can be entertained in person via Fozzy in Cleveland, Ohio.
Well, we played in Cleveland quite a few times. We did Uproar a couple years ago at the amphitheater there, and we played Peabody's a bunch of times, but I heard they just tore Peabody's down. Is that true?
It's gone, man. It's gone.
Wow. Why is that?
I know. I don't know. I have no idea. Apparently, it was too awesome, too good, too much of a hole in the center of the room, you know?
Oh, so are they rebuilding it somewhere else, or did it move, or is Peabody's just done?
I think it's just done.
Oh, that's a sad thing when they tear down. Peabody's was a classic rock and roll club in Cleveland. Great crowds. There's always so many great fans, but we're working on a new record right now. It's going to be coming out in June, so definitely when the tour starts, we'll be coming back through Cleveland. We'll just have to find another venue to play that's not Peabody, since it's no longer there.
Yeah. Alrighty, awesome.
That's cool, man. Well, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it.
Alrighty, I'll keep following you on the Twitter.
On the Twitter. Thanks, Chris. See you in Cleveland soon, my friend.
Bye.
All right, now we've got Charles from Chicago on the line. How you doing, Charles?
1, 2, 3, 1, 2. Hello, check. 1, 2.
Wait a second. This isn't Charles from Chicago. This is Charlie. Charlie Benanti, you're calling back. What's going on, man?
How are you?
I'm doing good. What's going on? What's your question today, young Charles?
My question is, did you watch the performance of the Beatles?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely, I watched it. I thought, what did you think? It's funny because I told you, I came home and I couldn't watch it because my son had taped cartoons and it cut off the DVR recording. But I finally eventually found it. I think we both in agreement that it was pretty darn good. What did you think?
I loved it. I could have, you know what? I was thinking to myself, I could watch a celebration of the Beatles every week if they want to do that.
Yeah. You know,
yes.
You said it best, too. Those interviews with Paul and Ringo were awesome. Like, I could just watch those guys talk about it for like hours and hours and hours.
I swear, it was like, for me, you know, and yourself being a Beatles fan forever, it seems like, I felt last night, like maybe for the first time, like it looked to me like Paul and Ringo, like, finally got it. Like, they are the Beatles.
Yeah. No, I agree, and I was actually even thinking when I was watching them play, like they did when they did Hey Jude together. I mean, Ringo should go out on tour with Paul and do the double drummer thing. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, and do when they did Sergeant Pepper,
oh yeah,
into With a Little Help from My Friends. I mean, dude, you said the same. Almost started crying.
I got choked up because it was like I've known this song since I was a little kid, but I've never seen these guys do it, like, you know.
Never.
It would have been great to see four of them do it, but you know what? Two of them doing it, it was just like, oh my God, you know, this is it right here, everybody, you know?
Absolutely. And like you said, they have never done that song live. I've never seen Paul do it. Obviously, why would he? It's Ringo's tune. That could be the first time that song has ever been played live by the Beatles.
I hope that maybe sparks something. You know, even if Ringo and Paul go out together and Ringo opens the show for whatever, and then they get together later on during Paul's set to just do a Beatle medley of things. And
yeah,
I mean, to me, you know, people would come just to see that, because that, let's face it, you have so many generations of people who would just be in awe, you know, to see that performed in front of you. Come on, man. It doesn't get any better.
Not that Paul's hurting for business, but I think that's a stadium tour waiting to happen. You know, I mean, if you look at, and the thing is, the precedent has been set now because the Stones have been doing that over the last year and a half with the 50th anniversary tour, where Mick Taylor comes out and plays three songs with them. He plays
Taylor.
Plays Midnight Rambler, he plays Sway, and he comes out at the end and plays Satisfaction. You could do the same with Ringo. Like you said, have Ringo's band and have Ringo put together one of them badass bands with like Frampton and Steve Lukather and like Kenny Aronoff. We were laughing last night that Kenny got more airtime than Abe did at the Grammys. But, you know, put together a badass band, go do his matchboxes and his photographs for, you know, 40 minutes or whatever. Then to have Paul do a set and bring Ringo up for three or four songs at the end. That'd be amazing.
That'd be awesome. It would be killer. And, you know, I read some posts from people saying, oh, they should have had George's son and, you know, Sean Lennon come up and stuff. And, yeah, that's, you know what, that's all great. That's all icing.
Yeah.
But for me, seeing these two guys up there, and it was funny because when the Eurythmics came out, Paul was sitting with Ringo, and they went to Paul and Ringo when what's his name from the Eurythmics?
Dave Stewart.
Dave Stewart. And Paul said to Ringo, look, it's Ringo. Ringo laughed. And it was like pretty funny because Dave Stewart kind of looks
he
like
does. I noticed that too with the Sullivan thing or in the Sullivan Theater with Letterman. And Paul said, you know, we're a good little band. And Ringo starts pointing himself and going, hey, hey. And Paul's like, no, he's a good little drummer and a good little band. Like, he hugged him. You can see there's that natural chemistry between the two of them. And they've probably tried to fight it for years. You know, it's just like, you know, it's when people ask me every single day, when are you going back to wrestling? When are you going back to wrestling? And it's like, after a while, you're like, I don't know. But then after, you know, those guys are probably have been asked so many times. But when they get back together, you can see there's still that chemistry from 50 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you spend, and, you know, we spoke about this, me, you, and Mike, about, you know, they were together for, what, 8, 9 years, whatever?
Yeah.
And then hit a rough spot and, of course, broke up. But the legacy that they left behind, and there's no way either one of them could ever escape the
yeah.
Beatles. And, you know, I don't think a day has gone by where they haven't been reminded of they were in the Beatles.
Yeah.
What a great thing to wake up to every morning. It's like, oh, what a shit day. Oh, wait, I'm in the Beatles.
That's right. I'm one of the Beatles, man. What difference does it make? You know, and you can see that, too, even in the 70s. I bought the Wings DVD that just came out, the live one. I can't remember if it was called Wings Over America. And
yeah.
Most of the set list is just Wings stuff. I mean, he's got Denny Lane singing songs. He's got the other guy that's not even in the band anymore singing songs. He went through that period in the 70s where he was like, I don't want to do Beatles anymore. And now he embraces it. And Ringo, I think, embraced it. They both look great. And we talked about this, too. They both sounded great. I mean, Ringo's not the best singer, but he sounded great last night. You know, for what
he was awesome.
Yeah,
right? He had so much energy, and it was just like, you know, I think this music—it's true, man. This is the fountain of youth.
Yeah,
these songs are you know close to 50 years old. Some of their songs.
Yeah,
but hearing them again and seeing the footage from the Ed Sullivan show, and it's like, man, here are these guys. Man, they were so young, and they just got caught up in this storm, this beautiful storm, you know, that
yeah.
was the Beatles. And it's so awesome that they always heard that, oh, this Ed Sullivan, you know, he's pretty big back in America. That's
yeah.
what he needs to do. And then Ed Sullivan was going the opposite way, like, oh, what's, you know, we heard about these Beatles, you know, what's this all about? So the marriage, I think, benefited both, you know.
Yes. Well, and it's like Paul and Ringo said, there are so many things that kind of happened, a real fate and happenstance to get that rolling. But you had a good point, man. They had a real connection last night, and it would be really cool to see them take that on the road and let Ringo do the Mick Taylor thing where he plays 3 or 4 songs at the end. And I think everybody, because, you know, listen, man, Ringo's 74 years old, Paul's 72. You just never know, and now's the time to do it, especially after last night, because that was a blast last night to watch that.
That was awesome last night, and I think that, you know how some musicians always have a way of, I call them, like, real excuses that they use for not doing something, and at the end of that whole line that they're going to say, you just think about it and like, dude, that's you know, maybe that was a good thing maybe 25-30 years ago, but there's really no need for you to give why you shouldn't do it, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I really think at this point in life and everything like that, and the Beatles were always about love and peace and everything, you know what, people want to see this, people love to see this, people love that feeling.
Yeah.
When go to a show and a song comes on, and whether it's with you and your kids or you and your, you know, your wife or husband, whoever it is, and that song comes on and you just, you know, it's like, that's it. You know, you do things that you don't even normally
yeah.
do in life. You start dancing some goofy dance. It's like, oh, we got caught up in the Beatle thing, you know?
Well, and I think just finally, you could see that. I mean, I remember Yoko last night was dancing. She's, what, 83, 82? She was dancing like she was 16. My favorite was Tom Hanks. He was standing there watching when I can't remember what song was going on, and he just had this look in his face of like, oh my God. Like, he wasn't Tom Hanks, the greatest actor ever. He was just some dude watching the Beatles. You know what I mean?
He was Forrest Gump.
Yes.
But, you know, something funny happened too, because like Dave Grohl, I know me and him, we share the same things as far as influences and stuff.
Yes.
His daughter is probably the same age as my daughter, and the speech that he gave about why he loved the Beatles.
Yeah.
exactly the same thing that it's like my history to the T, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, last night when we were watching it, my daughter was laying down like on my lap and we're watching it, and Ringo busted into Yellow Submarine and she just starts singing it. You know, she knows it. It's like a nursery rhyme.
Yeah, that's right. Good point. That's exactly right. And he had a girl's quote is that it was my mom's favorite band, it's my favorite band, and now it's my daughter's favorite band. And I think that's going to continue on for generations and generations. But Charlie, I could talk with the Beatles with you all day. I had a great time today talking with you and Mikey about the Beatles, and we'll have to pick another topic and get back on the line again soon and discuss Van Halen or something.
Oh, awesome. Okay. All
right. Thanks. Thanks, Charles from Chicago.
Yes. Thank you.
Talk to you soon, brother. Always cool to talk to my brother, Charlie. But thanks for listening today, and thanks for clicking on that Amazon banner every time you shop online. Remember, when you link to Amazon through Talk is Jericho, Amazon gives back a little something-something to this show. That keeps me doing this show for you for free. Remember, cowbells, they're getting out of hand in the price zone. It's so expensive to have a good cowbell. And believe me, this is the deluxe version cowbell because it sounds better online. It really does. So if you want me to continue doing this show with these amazing cowbells for free, go to podcastone.com, click on Talk is Jericho, then hit that Amazon link. Thank you so much. On Friday, remember, we're twice a week now, Anthrax's Scott Ian will be here to talk about his Speaking Words tour, all things Anthrax, and the passing away, the early passing away of Cliff Burton. Scott was there. Check it out. It's a great conversation. Peace and love. Hugs. Stay cool. Stay hard. Stay heavy. We'll see you all on Friday. God bless you.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million, what color is the White House?
I know this.
5 seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay. Judges? That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo!
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
You're listening to Love Advice with Leanne. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Leanne. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Why, in your professional opinion, do you never take my calls off the air?
Is this Carl?
Yep, it's Carl. I mean, we had a few dates. Everything was great, I thought.
Well, you know, when you switch to Geico, you could save a lot of money on car insurance.
Okay, awesome.
You should call them.
I will.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Syria Peace Talks? I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute. Syrian rebels have rejected peace talks being proposed by Russia. They're accusing Moscow of failing to pressure its ally, President Bashar Assad, to end the conflict. Christmas may be over, but the shopping isn't. Hazel Ginn was at Macy's Herald Square in New York today.
It's not too bad. Even we went up to the 9th floor and we managed to get in a queue of about 4 deep, so not bad. Yeah, and then we went to another one and it was only a couple, so we kind of timed it well, I think.
America's research group, which focuses on consumer behavior, projects holiday sales up about 5% this year. Harley-Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The company is expanding the number of dealerships with a Harley Riding Academy. The move comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. I'm Ben Thomas.